Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 2, delivered on January 19, 2012. The title of this lecture is Foundations of the Discipline.
Today, Foundations of the Discipline. As I told you, finance is a subdiscipline of economics, but whereas economics focuses on both consumers and institutions, businesses, finance is much more business oriented. That doesn't mean that we don't look at consumers, but we look at them as consumers of financial products. More broadly, as consumers, all people who work in finance are consumers of information products. Now, we get our information products from a variety of sources. We get them from accountants. We also get information products from the horse's mouth. We'll talk to CEOs of company. We'll talk to investment analysts. We'll even talk to government officials and hold our noses. We are consumers, voracious consumers of information. That's how we make our financial decisions. Now, there are three broad areas of finance, and they do cross each other. The first one I would mention would be financial management. That's where you work inside of a company, and you're one of the people who decides whether projects are an up or a down, a go or a no-go, accept or reject the project. We look at capital financing. How do we get the money together to do this project? We look at the concerns inside the company of how the money is being spent and how our balance of different uses and sources of money are playing, how they're changing, where we want them to be, how we keep them where we want them to be, and if we're going to change them, how do we do it? So that's financial management. You work inside of a company. It's an indoor job. It doesn't suck. Now, the second area is one probably you would think more of as finance. That's investments. That's brokers and dealers and traders and all of those kinds of people. The meat and potatoes of stock and bond markets, that kind of stuff. That's investments, and that's a world of its own. You have to get your degree in finance, and then you go and you get licenses and certifications. A lot of people, when they go into finance, they'll find out, well, the degree is just the first step. Now I have to get something like a CFA, Certified Financial Analyst thing. It's a brutal process. Or if I'm going to be a broker or a trader, I have to get a Series 7 license. That's another one that's brutal. Did any of you see the movie In Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith? It's actually a great movie. It's based on a true story. It's actually kind of harshly true. But don't get the idea that you're going to be as successful as that guy. It's a really hard place to be. And I have students all say, oh, I want to get into being a trader or a broker. It's a meat grinder. A lot of my students over the years, they've ended up doing the work in the boiler rooms, essentially cold calling people, trying to sell crap stock to them. And only if you survive that and are successful will they let you go upstairs. Most people burn out in that kind of a business. Back in my day, if you were a trader on Wall Street, if you were actually on the floor of an exchange, you were probably a cokehead. You would blow the coke before the bell opened, and then if you got too excited, you'd cut it with some heroin, and you'd have your coke and horse. The heroin as a sedative would calm you down so you didn't fly off the walls and have a propeller on your head and go through the ceiling. That's how vicious it was out there in that day. Is it different now? Oh, of course it is. We're all in a time when we all obey the law and we're all good people. Okay. Anyway, that's a tough place to be. And your dream of being some high-powered, money-making person in that business, you're going to fight tooth and nail. You're going to have a very tough day most days. And some people, they love it. They just absorb it. Others, within a few minutes, they say, oh, FTS, I am not going to do this. Oh, hell no. I'll go sell flowers at a hippie commune. But like I said, there are a lot of people who are really into that. Now, investments, okay. Here's the third one, and here's where I begin to have to say, well, there's these crossing areas of the three. The third one is institutions. Institutions. Finance people can get into banking, investment banking, commercial banking, personal private banking. There's all these different places where you can go. If you don't want that, it's insanely high-powered world of the traders, and if you really don't want to work with a company, you can work for a bank. You can work, like I said, there are commercial banks, there are your regular private banks, or you can work for one of the government's banks, the Federal Reserve System, and I'll be getting into that next week, talking about the Federal Reserve System. And there are opportunities there. Now, I am an advisor to the Financial Management Association here at Illinois State University. And last semester, one of the guest speakers that we had come in was one of the Treasury Department people, one of the people who goes to the banks and audits them and goes through their books and tells them this, your capital requirements need to be changed or everything's okay and all that. So you can work for the government overseeing the institutions. Now you think, well, that sounds like that's kind of lame work. She works 4 days a week, she's home every night, and she's pulling more money than anyone you know. And if you work in the right part of the Treasury Department, I have an IRS person who asked me to recruit for the IRS. Treasury Department agents who are out there in the field, like those guys are, Treasury people, they get to carry guns. That's real cool. Get to shoot the ass off some corporate son of a bitch. But and so there is a lot out there in the institutions kind of realm. You can work in a financial institution, or you can work in the government as a regulator and provider for financial institutions. So these are the large three areas. Now know this though. Okay, a company needs money. There are three ways that a company can get money. Three ways. They can get money by borrowing. That's debt. Essentially, any bill that a company has is a debt. But if we're talking about capital projects, in other words, big, big stuff, then they would go out and they would borrow big money. So they can get money for projects through debt. Now, that's one place. Now, the other two are called equity. Now, these other two, one of those is they can sell stock. And then, in other words, they get new owners. And those people who want to be new owners pay money to be owners of the company, to have a residual claim on cash flow. So now we've got a company can issue debt, sell debt, and get debt money, borrow money, or it can issue stock and have money that way. What's the third way that a company can get money for projects and for bills? Okay, really? What's the other way? How about earning it? Yeah, actually selling a product and, you know, actually getting revenue and paying bills from your revenues. Here's a clue. Sooner or later, you're going to have to earn revenue. Now, know this. After you've paid your regular bills in a timely manner, the money at that net income line in the income statement, that's equity. it is every bit as much equity as money that you generate from selling stock. The equity, that money that's at the bottom line, you've paid your debts for the period, anything that was due. And so what's there at the bottom line is owner's money. So you can either give it to the owners as dividends. I mentioned this last time. You can give it to the owners as dividends, or you can plow it back into the company's operations for projects and stuff like that. But it is an equity. We call the money at the bottom line internally generated equity. Internally generated equity. In other words, you're generating it through your ops. Now, if you bring in money from selling stock, we call that externally generated equity. They're both money that arises from an ownership claim or formation. It's equity, as opposed to getting money through borrowing it. That's debt. Know this, and we'll get into this later in the course much more seriously. Debt money is hellaciously cheaper than equity money. Debt money is just insanely cheaper, at least up to a point. If you borrow too much, then you get really risky because you might not be able to pay off all of it. But for a long, long time, debt is just so cheap for a couple of reasons. First of all, one of them is that when you pay interest on debt, it's tax deductible. The interest is tax deductible. So that basically lowers your after-tax cost of the debt. But the other reason is debt has the prior claim on any cash flows that happen. The debt holders get theirs before the shareholders get theirs. So it's a safer position. It's a safer position than the equity is. Because the equity, I mean, you get something if there's something left over. The debt holders, they get theirs, and if you don't pay them in a timely fashion, they'll shut you down and take your company away from you. So there are two reasons debt is cheaper. One is because its interest is tax deductible, and the second reason is simply that it's a safer position. So the debt holders are not going to expect as high a rate of return as the shareholders would. You'll see in this course, for example, in some cases, the cost of your first tranche of debt might be 6.5%. Your cost of internally generated equity is over 20%. That's how bad it is. Go ahead.
So when you're talking debt, are you talking both bank loans and bonds?
Anything that is not paying the shareholders is debt. Anything is. Believe it or not. If you have a bill to pay, your light bill at the company, that's debt. You borrowed that light, that electricity from the electric company, and now the bill has come due. Your employees, what you owe them in salary, that's a debt of the company. You have to pay that before the owners can get a dime out of that company. I'm glad you brought that up. I really am. Because I've noticed that I kind of gloss over this. In the past, I kind of glossed over it. Anything that's not equity is debt. A payment to the equity is debt. But formally speaking, we always like to think about bonds and notes and all of that. Those are our biggies for debt. We think about those most. But really, anything that's not being paid to the shareholders or that the shareholders can claim is a debt of some kind. Now, I'm going to bring up some terminology here and some conceptualization. Something that happens in college, and this is true wherever you are in college, but in business programs, I'm very blunt about it. We are kind of separating you from the common person in the sense that what we're doing is we are making you so that you can see the world a little bit more clearly, in a more structured way than the average person does. It gets kind of frustrating once you know some of these things, trying to explain to someone who doesn't have this knowledge base what's really going on. And these can be very basic concepts. And they'll just kind of stare at you like, "Why? What the hell are you talking about?" But we really need you to be above the average bear. You're going to be smarter than Yogi Bear. Well, no, Yogi Bear was smarter than the average bear. Okay. Let's start with a couple of concepts here. First of all, when you borrow money, you, the borrower, are the issuer of the debt. You're the issuer of the debt instrument. The lender is the buyer of the debt instrument. Let me explain. You finally, you've gotten through the program and you're going to buy yourself your first car. You want a really nice car. You want one of those cars that's really cool. Maybe a Metro or something like that. A Yaris or whatever the hell it is. Or what's that one that's like shaped like a box, like sky on? Yeah, don't they recall for ugly? But yeah, okay, so you need to borrow, let's say, 15 grand. So you go to the bank and say, I should like to borrow $15,000 so I can have a babe machine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to get a Volkswagen bus, Super Beetle, 1973 refurbished. Okay, now, when you borrow that money, you are actually issuing to the bank a piece of paper. In this case, it's called a note, and I'll get into that in a minute. The bank agrees to buy it for the price of $15,000. They buy that note from you. You say, wait a minute, I didn't write the note. Well, no, you didn't. They'll prepare it as a standardized document. But literally, once it's on the table, you are the one who signs it and then pushes it over to them, saying, please buy this note that I am issuing. And by prearrangement, they'll probably have already told you, yes, we're going to do this. They'll sign it, agreeing to buy it. The purchase price will be the $15,000. They won't give it to you directly. They'll give it to the car company. And there might be an attachment, an annex on the note itself, the promissory note, backing it with the collateral of the car itself. That would be a secondary. But the note itself, you issued that to them. The price was the amount they lent you for it. So always keep that in mind. And I like to ask a question like that on a quiz and even on your first exam. Look, you've done this kind of a borrowing kind of deal. You lent a friend $10. Okay, who's the issuer? Who's the purchaser? The borrower is the issuer. The borrower is the issuer. You get, okay, that's the first thing. The lender is the purchaser. Now let's go on to the next part of this. We distinguish different kinds of debt, all kinds of ways, but one way we do it is by the time to maturity. The time to maturity. In general, as a rule, any kind of a debt instrument that is less than a year in duration, it has to be paid off fully within a year. That we call a bill. A bill. Now let me clarify on that. One of the most common kinds of bills that is out there commercially would be treasury bills. Very short-term borrowings the government makes for cash, working capital kind of cash to pay quick debts. These things, I'll bring one up a little later in this lecture, a treasury bill, a T-bill of exactly 1 year in length. And it's called a bill because it's due in 1 year. The government has to pay the investors, the lenders, the buyers of the bill back in a year. Now, it gets more serious than that, though, because you've been using the word bill for years. You all get bills in the mail. I get them. They go right to the trash. But you get bills all the time. You know what? You are actually the issuer of those bills you get in the mail. That goes back to what I brought up a minute ago. You are the issuer. I got a bill in the mail. You issued a bill to someone. No, I didn't. They issued me a bill. I got it in the mail. No, they just gave you written evidence of a bill that you issued to them. You used electricity. They put it on your tab. They didn't charge you a penny every second your lights were on. They let it accumulate. They were simply accepting that you were incurring a debt with them, and now you get that bill in the mail. It's what you created. All they're doing is telling you how much you issued in debt that they now want back. Why is it a bill? Because you are going to have to pay it within 30 days or something like that. That's why we call them bills, and we are the issuers. Even though they come to us in the mail, we were the one who created the debt instrument. And the electric company simply agreed to provide for us the price of the electricity until we had to pay it back to them, or whatever other bill you've got. You get a bill for your tuition here. That bill you issued because you said, I want you to accept me as a student, and therefore, please put this on my tab, the tuition, until I have to pay it. And then all of a sudden, they say, all right, here's the evidence of that bill that you issued. It's a piece of paper, but you were the issuer of the bill. They provided the tuition until it came due for you to satisfy that debt obligation. You following me on that? That's kind of it's very difficult to think in those terms because we always think of a bill as someone else sending something to us. But what we get is actually just evidence of what we have already done. It's sort of like, I won't get into that right now. Now, the next level of term of maturity is what we call a note, something that's between a year and about 7 years. Those are notes. They have to be paid off with between a year and 7 years. Now, you would be most familiar with notes. Actually, there's one note that's much more common for you to use, but I'll bring that up in a minute. The one that you would probably be most accepting of is the note of when you borrow for a car. Usually a car loan is for a new car is, or even for a used car, is somewhere between 3 years and 6 years. That's typical. So in other words, when you borrow money for a car, you are the issuer of a note because you have to have it fully satisfied within sometime between 1 and 7 years. So car loans are a great example of a note. Now I'm going to show you another great example of a note here, even much far more common. Madam, what does it say at the top of this thing right here?
The Federal Reserve note.
Federal Reserve note. I said this is a dollar bill, but it's actually a dollar note. It says it right there. It's a note. It is actually a debt obligation that lasts somewhere between 1 and 7 years. Essentially, the government borrows the money from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve gives the evidence of the debt obligation of the federal government to the Federal Reserve via these pieces of paper, which are commonly used by the people of the country as fiat money. But this is a debt obligation. The government owes this to the Federal Reserve. Now, and of course, I said it's paid off between 1 and 7 years. How are these paid off? Do you know how these are paid off? You guys took economics and they didn't tell you this? They take them back and they shred them and they print a couple more. You say, wait, what? Yes, that's exactly how they're paid off. They eventually, these get old. They have a life of about 5 years or so. They grind them up. They go back to the banks. Bank says, oh, that's an old. They send them back, and then they're ground up, and a couple more are printed in its place. That's how these are paid off. No, don't try that yourselves, for God's sake. They're all kind of quiet about that. You didn't know that's how it's done? That's the note. That's how we satisfy the notes. Bonds. James Bond. Bonds are more than 7 years in duration. Typical bond maturities are 10, 15, 20, 30. Bonds can go 50, 100. There are bonds that are actually even longer in duration than that. Bonds are long-term debt obligations. In your lives, in your personal lives, your most likely exposure to bonds will be through a borrowing for a house. like you might get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That would be, okay, let me go through it this. Let me do it this way. You've finally gotten your degree here. You've got your job at State Barn. You've gotten married. And so you want to live the dream. You buy a house trailer. Double wide. You double wide wife. Okay. So you say, all right, I'd like a 20-year loan. And so you get a loan from a bank for 20 years. Okay, now, let's talk. Is this a bill, a note, or a bond? Okay, it's a bond. Now, who is the issuer of the debt instrument?
Me.
You are the issuer. Who is the buyer of the debt instrument? As a lender. Okay, what's the price that I am paying as the buyer of your debt instrument? For a double wide trail? Okay, maybe in some neighborhoods, yeah. Yeah, back when they were overvaluing property back in those days, yeah, it was. Yeah, but it's whatever you need to borrow. Yeah, that's the price of it. So it's a fully structured concept. You're the issuer, the bank is the prearranged, essentially what we call an underwriter. It's already underwritten this. You've made the arrangements before you even decide to go and buy the house and buy the Elvis velvet paintings to put in the living room and all that, okay? Now, here's the thing, though. In your personal lives, the debts that you see, like borrows, loans for cars, loans for houses, things like that, loans, student loans, those are not exactly structured like corporate and government debt. The loans that you and I get in our personal lives, when we make payments on them, we make payments that cover the interest on the principal and knock down the principal a little bit. Every payment does some of both. You service the debt and amortize the principal. That's how payments work. And I'll show you. It's really easy with these modern calculators to figure out the payments on loans. Yeah.
So even though you're making payments
sooner than like a year or so, it still would be considered 100 notes? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it would depend upon when it's supposed to be due. You might pay it off early. Suppose you had, a car loan for 6-7 years, and suddenly you came into money 6 months from now and you paid it off, it was still a note, even though you paid it off early. As a matter of fact, corporations do this trick all the time. Not all the time, but corporations can sometimes, they have like a 30-year bond. They can do a trick called a call on it where they just pay it off. They would do that because interest rates have gone down so they can refi at a lower rate, just like you can. So it has to do with actually what's stated in the contract, what we call it. I'm glad you asked it. That's good. Now, know this, though. With personal loans, the payment pays the interest on the principal, and it knocks down the principal a little bit. It services the debt and amortizes a little bit of the principal. With corporate and government debt, it doesn't do that. The payments, which are called coupons, in the fancy world of corporate and government, pay only the interest. And then at the end, the face of the debt is paid off in one big wad. That's how it works. So if IBM borrows $100 million on an 8% coupon bond issue, every year the lenders, they get a check for the interest, 8% of $100 million. Would I say $100 million? Okay, so what the hell is 8% of $100 million? $8 million. So every year for 30 years, if it's a 30-year bond, the lenders get nothing but an 8% check, 8% of the face value of the debt. And then at the end, in other words, all that's happening through the life of a corporate bond or a government bond is that the debt is being serviced. In other words, it's just being held in place, and then at the end, the corporation or the government has to pay off the face value of the debt. Now, of course, bondholders are going to have covenants in the contract, the lending contract, saying you got to put money aside every year so that you can pay this off at the end. There are sinking fund provisions in these contracts and all of that. But that's how it works. Is that corporate and government debt, they almost never amortize any of the principal. The principal just sits there, what's called the face value. Now, for the purposes of this course, and so help me God, you have to remember this. Unless I say differently, the face value is $1,000. The face value is $1,000. Well, what if they want to borrow $1 million? Then they issue enough bonds to cover $1 million. But the face value of a single bond in corporate and finance and tickers, in everything we do, we assume it is $1,000. And when a company wants to borrow, let's say, $100,000, it would issue $100 bonds. Because each one will have a face of, and you'll hear me use the word face on it, face of $1,000. So if I give you a bond problem or a debt problem of any kind, and I don't mention how much they borrowed, it is $1,000, always. And that's literally what you key in on your calculator in this special part of the calculator. You punch in $1,000 for what the company has to pay at the end of the debt. And again, okay, there is one arena of exception to that coupon thing where you pay coupons along the way to service the debt. They're called discount instruments. Now, the most common kind of discount instrument out there is when the government borrows on one of those one-year T-bills that I was telling you about. They usually simply say, lend us something less than $1,000, and in 1 year we'll give you $1,000. That's how they work. In other words, we just simply say, these kinds of debt instruments sell at a discount to par. So essentially, when you get the $1,000 back, the gravy between what you paid, maybe $950 and $1,000, is the interest you made on the bond. There's a corporate version of this that turned really nasty years ago, back in the heyday of the Michael Milkins and all that, and there's some of them are still being issued to this day. They're a trick called a ZCB, a zero coupon bond. What it is, it's a corporate bond, except that it doesn't work like normal corporate bonds. The company doesn't pay a coupon every year. Instead, what the company does is it just says, we'll pay you back $1,000 in 7 years. Lend us some money today. And then we'll pretend you don't exist until 7 years from now. It's essentially what we call a deep discount bond. You'll make your money on the difference between what you lent them, say $600, and what they send you in the mail 7 years from now, $1,000. These are incredibly risky instruments. A company would do that only if it knew it wasn't going to be able to generate enough revenue to pay interest on a normal coupon type of basis. ZCBs were one of those junk bond kinds of tricks that was being done in the heyday of the bad guys in the 1990s. They essentially say, we're going to start these dot-coms, these highly risky companies that won't generate revenue for 5 years, but boy, is it a great idea. Now, you investors who want to lend us money, tell you what, you lend us $500, we'll pay you back $1,000 in 6, 7, 8, 10 years. Really, that's what we'll do. Of course, the companies weren't around in 6, 7, 8, 10 years, so they went tap city, but there you are, that's how it works. Zero coupon bonds are very risky animals out there. I'm going to show you something here. If I can, let me qualify this. If I can actually lift this thing up. How the hell does this work? I almost hurt something I care about doing that. Is there some reason this sucks? I've never had this thing down before. It's always been up. Oh, there it is. Oh, God. Okay. the hell? Now, how's this? That thing is jiggling, is it? Yeah, that makes me want to hurl. Okay. Gotta show you something here. I'm much more familiar, used to whiteboards, but that's how it is these days. See if I got something I can actually write on this thing with. Or maybe I can write on it with this. This is just a little bit of a, just an exercise to give you an idea of math and finance. Some of it's actually kind of stupid math. It's not hard math at all. You just have to remember the rules, how you do things. And thank God for financial calculators and all of that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through an exercise here where the Treasury of the United States is about to do a Treasury auction. Now, literally, a Treasury auction is where the United States government, through the Treasury, puts paper on a table and says, please buy it, rich investors of the world. In other words, that's how the government borrows money, is at an auction where Treasury paper, bills, notes, bonds, sometimes it's all of one, sometimes it's like a mix. They put it, literally, back in the old days, not now, it's all electronic, but they put it on the table and they'd say, rich investors of the world, please come and buy our paper, this Treasury paper. In other words, please lend us money. We are the issuer of this paper. You will be the purchasers of the paper. We are the borrowers, the United States government. You are the lenders, the investors of the world who buy that kind of stuff. So you follow how this is going to work. Now, anymore, it's all electronic and all that. But in the back in the day, and it still is the same thing, except it's all virtual now. Back in the day, there was paper on the table. And investors would come, investors from all over the world. And to this day, they will come from all over the world. Most of them come to lend us money from China. Why does China have all that money to lend? You're the ones who did it, and I'm the ones who did it. We bought cheap Chinese goods because they pegged their currency low, and all that, those American dollars we bought them with flowed to the People's Bank of China, and then the People's Bank of China can't spend American dollars anywhere but in America, so they come to our auctions and lend us money so that we can live off debt instead of taxes and prudent spending. Okay, that's how it works. So you've got the Chinese there. You have some Arabs there because we buy a lot of oil and all that. You have the Japanese there. Canadians are there big time because they've got a lot of our American dollars from exports to us. And so they've got a lot that they can lend us at our Treasury auctions. You have institutional investors, massive trust funds, insurance companies. You have investors from shadowy places that wear sunglasses and they come in and they sometimes even try to act real cool. But back in the day, I mean, there were, you don't even know who they are anymore, but here's how it works. We're going to do it old school. Let's see, I got to find someone who's going to be my buyer here. You, sir, up there at the back, I'm going to use you for this. You're the buyer. You're going to lend. You're actually, you come into the auction. You come to the auction, and there's paper on the table, and you're just kind of walking around, and I am the hostess and the seller of the Treasury instruments for the day. My name is Mabel. Well, how are you doing there? Did you come to buy a Treasury bill from me? They're due in 1 year, so you'll get $1,000 in 1 year. You look like the kind of person who could buy one of these. Okay, well, we got a lot of buyers here. So you're going to have to give me a good price. Don't play with me now, because there's other people who will buy it at a better price. Remember, you get $1,000 in 1 year, so give me a price. I'd like to hear something like maybe $975. Would that be okay with you?
$974.
Well, kiss my ass. It's going to be $975. Right. Oh, you're such a young man.
Now, let's see here. Let me find a pretty one for you among these. Oh, this one's got some gold filigree on it. Okay. Hey, Earl, one treasury bill. Hold the lettuce and tomato. Would you like that in a bag? Good. Okay. So I give you your treasury bill, and you leave. Let's talk. The treasury bill, the price of the treasury bill was $975. Now, by the way, on a quote sheet, you would see 97.5. Historically, since Jesus walked the earth, we have quoted at a tenth of actual price. Always. So when I say quote me, you always quote it at a tenth. I know why. It was because in the old days they needed to save a column width in the financial papers. So everything was quoted at a tenth of its actual price. I know a guy who actually didn't know that. And he thought he was actually buying a debt instrument for, it was like $900 and some dollars. He thought he was paying $92 or something like this. He almost had a heart attack when his account was hit. Who did this? Where did this come from? This is the way it's always been. What the hell? Okay, $975 is the price. Now, face value of this instrument. What is he going to get 1 year from today? $1,000 is what he's going to get a year from today. FV, the future value, the face value, is always going to be $1,000 unless I say differently. With consumer loans, it can be all over the place, obviously, but this is corporate. Now, let's talk about the dollar interest that he will earn over one exact year. How much dollar interest will he earn? $25. See, hey, $975. He got $1,000, so in 1 year he got exactly $25. Now here's the final part. Let's talk about, we can now say, all right, what's the yield on this instrument? An exactly 1 year yield. We always do 1 year annuals, and this one's perfect for it. A 1 year yield on this would be $25 in interest divided by what? What was his investment? $975. If you write $1,000 in the denominator, I will eat your ass. I promise you. So you better bring mayonnaise. You see, that's nasty. God. I will put the answer that you would get for putting $1,000 there. I will put the wrong answer. I was a math teacher. I know how you get the wrong answer, and I will set your ass up for it. What's 25 divided by 975? It should be 5.26. Is that right? 2.56. You make sure you can do that. 2.56%. Don't give me 0.02569111. Give me two decimal places always. Unless I say differently, you give me two decimal places. You will have your feelings hurt if you show me that your calculator can do a zillion decimal places and I take a point off. Don't do that to me. Two decimal places as a percentage. Now, it's 0.02564 blah, blah. You times that by 100, and it rounds to 2.56%. 2.56%. Oh, God. Every time I mark on this, they have a fit. Okay. So you earn 2.56%. Well, you're going to say, well, that sucks.com. Well, it's cheap. Your yield is low because it's the U.S. government. Well, I heard the government is going to default on its debt. Oh, bullshit. They'll invade another country, for God's sake, to pay off their bills. Iran's on the table. Let's hope not France. I hate the French stuff that we could get in a pillaging raid. So you've made it through that first year, and it was good. You show back up again at another treasury auction. And I'm still there. I'm Mabel. Mabel, oh, there you are again. You just got your $1,000, and you're back to buy another one. Isn't that nice? You know, you should eat more. You're kind of skinny there. Don't you have a girl? Or wait a minute, are you one of those guys who coaches at Penn State or something like that? Oh, I'm going to hell for that. I will. I will go to hell. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. Well, we can sell you one of those at $9.75, and this time you get Butch. You say, let me look around the room. Oh, gee, I don't see anyone buying. Oh, my God. Where are all those Chinese? Oh, they're at home shooting their students again. Where are the Arabs? Oh, they're saying, you go America, bomb Iran, you pigs. Don't do it. Yes, do it. Where are the Japanese? Oh, they're watching Hentai. It's the tentacle edition. Okay, never mind. Before your time. Where the hell was I? Okay, you say there's no one around here.
Well, you're right about that.
So what are you going to offer me for a price this time? You better believe it. Let's say you hit me at $9.50. Oh, you drive a hard bargain. But, of course, the government will simply pay whatever interest rate it has to. There is no, gee, let me think about whether I want to lend. That's people and corporations do that. Sovereign entities never react to the interest rate. So, in this case, we've come to an agreement, $9.50. Earl, one treasury bill. This time, drag it through the garden, $9.50. And put it in a bag. Where are you going to get back in a year? How much dollar interest did you make? So now let's do the yield again. What do I do? Top is what? Love it when you talk like that. Bottom is what? Oh, good. I don't have to eat any ass. Now, if you do 50 divided by 950, and again, don't try to impress me by how many decimal places. Don't sneak in a third one just to show me that you're boss. I kicked his ass. I put 3 decimal places on. What? 5.26%. There you go. Well, that was certainly fun, and that'll at least get you to second base at the singles bar showing that. Or not, maybe not. Okay. But let's talk. You're seeing there an example of one of the most fundamental principles of finance. It has nothing to do with this particular bond and all that. It's a deep, deep principle of finance. What happened to the yield as the price went down? Look, what happened to the yield as the price went down? The yield went, well, spank me, Jesus. It doesn't matter how complex the instrument is. It's okay, Jesus and I are both Jewish. It was a long story. I just got out of Judea before things got bad with the Romans. Don't rely on me for shit. Okay. Here's the thing, though. Do you see what happens? As price goes down, yield goes up. That principle is so pervasive that it is one of the most fundamental principles in all of finance. Price goes down, yield goes up on anything. The cheaper it is, the higher the yield will be, all other factors being held equal. It's just how it works. And obviously the other way too. So as the price goes up, the yield goes down. But here's the second principle that's involved in this. There are two people. Find someone I can pick on here. I try to get everyone humiliated by the time the court summons. You woman. You've got money to lend. Okay. Now, this upstanding Presbyterian stud wants to borrow money. He's going to promise to pay you back $1,000 in a year. He comes from a very well-to-do family. He's well-connected. He actually has a contract printed up by the lawyers. And he's just really a reliable, good guy. And so he's going to pay you back $1,000 in a year. It's a promissory bill. Okay? Well, let's say a year and a day. So it would therefore be a promissory note. You see that? A year and a day would be a note. Okay, so you're going to lend him some money. It'll be a discount, one of those discount kinds of instruments, because there won't be any interest along the way. You'll just lend him a short amount of money, and then he'll pay you back $1,000, so your interest will be your spread. Okay. Now, you're considering lending him money, buying his promissory note that he is issuing. And then here I come along. Now, I'm obviously not reputable. As a matter of fact, I'm damn disreputable in the evenings. You woman, I need to borrow some money. A year and a day from now, I'll pay you back $1,000. $1,000, excuse me, a little bit of gas there. It's not beer, it's my hernia. I got a napkin here. I'm going to, I owe you one year and a day for now. I'm going to give you a damn $1,000. Yeah, there you go. Now lend me some money. Now, who are you going to lend more money to? Remember, we're both going to pay you back $1,000 in a year and a day. Okay, fine. You maybe lend him $900. So you would earn $100 on a $900 investment. That would be an 11% return. Okay. Now me, I'll be lucky if you give me change for coffee. But let's say you're a kind-hearted, good-natured kind of young woman, and only infrequently do you kill people, but that's at night when you've read some Harley Quinn stuff and all that. Okay. Maybe you lend me $500. So on your investment in me, you would make, if I actually paid it off, you'd make $500 on a $500 investment. That's a 100% return. Do you see that? So for him, 11%. For me, I have to pay 100%. Can you tell me, in a nutshell, the relationship between risk and expected return? Who had the higher risk, him or me? Which one do you expect the higher return from? 11%, yeah, me, 100%. Wait, yeah, right. In other words, the basic principle here is that the higher the risk, the higher the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. In financial markets, something that is riskier is not going to get by with a cheap price, a cheap return. So, in other words, look at what happened. The price of my note was 500. The price of his note was 900. The yield on his note was 11%. The yield on my note was 100%. The risk was directly related to the expected return. I am high risk, I had to pay 100%. He is low risk, he had to pay only 11.1%. This is one of the most pervasive of all principles in finance, is that if you are going to bear higher risk, you must expect a higher return for it. That's how financial markets work. And if you're expecting a higher return, that probably means there's going to be a cheaper price on it. So that means that when you go to the financial pages and you open them up, oh, look at this. Well, we got these fancy stocks selling for $50 a share, $100 a share. Well, look here. Martha, I found the blue light special. There's a stock that's selling for 25 cents. Here's one that's selling for 85 cents. What do you suppose that means about the risk of those investments in those blue light specials? They're essentially hugely risky. You expect a massive return on them, which you probably won't get, but that's why they're so cheap. The lower price means higher yield, and the higher yield means a higher risk profile on it. I'm going to show you something here. Fine, so I'm going to pick on you. Madam, I would like you to stand on the train tracks. Well, actually, lie down on the train tracks and just lie there for 24 hours, and I'll give you $5. What? That's $5. That's got Abraham Lincoln. You can trust Abe, really. And I'm good for it. As a matter of fact, I'll even put it in my shoe. I don't take my shoes off. It'll be a little bit sticky when I... $5. There you go. Capitalist. Too risky. Now, suppose I said, how about if I gave you $1,000,000? If you would get on the train tracks for 24 hours. 10? Look!
Am I allowed to get up when the train's coming?
No, you lie down flatter so it goes over. Ba, ba, ding, 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 ding. I hope there's nothing drag catches you underneath. Ah! You just lie flat. Don't worry, there's space under. Haven't you seen the movies where they lie like this? Ding, 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 ding. See, risk. There are a lot of professions that you can go into that are extraordinarily risky, but you don't do it unless someone is going to pay you, unless you are really stupid. Yeah, I'm doing it for the adventure, and you're going to be dog meat too, fool. You see, matter of fact, good example. You know, have you ever heard of a kind of professional called a glow boy? Do you know what a glow boy is? You ever heard it? Any of you? Glow boy is a person who actually is dropped down into nuclear reactors to fix problems in the core area. They're called glow boys. They travel all over the world. They might have to work 5-10 days a year. They're paid unbelievably good money. Unbelievably good money. The return to them is very high. Why is it very high, do you suppose? Because it is quite risky. You hear the wrong beep, and suddenly you look down, and your lower half is gristle. The same is true in many professions. High-risk professions tend to pay more. Why do they pay more? Because they are high risk. Higher risk, higher expected return on your project. And this is something that takes us to our final lesson for this happy day we have together as a happy family. That's the latest it's been today. Just enough time for this. Moving you forward into the world of finance, this exciting world, this world of romance, of music and dance. Suppose a company is looking at three projects and their returns on investment. Project A has an ROI, and we'll do this as an investment opportunity schedule, an IOS. Project A has an ROI of 18%. Project B has an ROI of 10%. And Project C has an ROI of 6%. Let's talk. Suppose that these three projects, the marginal cost of capital, the last dollar you would borrow, costs you 5% for use in projects through equity, a combination of equity and debt. Would you go with Project A? Would you accept Project A? You get the, you're paying 5% for the money. The project will pay you 18%. Would you take Project A? Here's a hint. Hell yeah. Would you take Project B? Sure. Would you take Project C? Of course. Of course you would, because you get the money at 5%, 6%. Hell, I'll pick a penny up off the street. I'm that way. You will take on any project that pays more than the marginal cost of the capital to fund it. Sure you will. You'll take on all three of these projects. What happens if the interest rate environment suddenly goes up so that the marginal cost of capital goes to 8%? Will you still take on Project A? Sure. Take on Project B? Absolutely. How about Project C? No. In technical terms, you'll say, bite me. But finance, it's got technical language. Well, what happens if the marginal cost of capital rises to 12%? Will you take on Project A? Sure. What about Project B? Nope. Project C has gone south all the way. Look at what's happening as the interest rate environment rises. First of all, business investment is being cut off. More importantly, though, what's happening to the overall risk of the portfolio of investments the company is taking on? Do you see how the average was maybe a risk of about 11%, commensurate with 11%? At the end, when the interest rates went up, this company was backed into a corner. The only way projects it could take were the ones that had the highest risk. In other words, in a difficult interest rate environment, companies go for the Hail Marys. They're forced to. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.